Hello, hello. We are here on the Sales Edge podcast. This is Celeste, your host, and I am here with someone who, when you all listen to this, may think, what the heck does this have to do with sales? But I'm about to dive in, and our guest today, we will draw some parallels into sales. It is none other than my father, Robert Burke. So I'm sure I will miss a couple of things and he can fill us in here in a moment, but he is a just celebrated 41 years in business as a small business owner, well into the seven, maybe eight figure business. So he can talk to us about that. Has an MD, an MPH, an MD from McGill, an MPH from Harvard, an MBA from some other place. It'll come to me. As well as a host of other accolades, including being an acupuncturist, has attempted six Ironmen in the last 18 years, completed two, whole nother episode we can devote just to Ironman. But this is my dad, father of four, still working almost full time, as well as teaching spin class, as well as other things. So we will get into it. Lived in Africa for 3 years, worked for the Canadian government. It goes on and on. What did I miss?
25 years as a county health commissioner in the county. Went through some rather interesting events there. Yeah, there's a lot packed in there that could be unpacked over a long period of time. One of the things, you know, when you talk about business, they don't train doctors very well because our training is, you know, there's a whole lot of other things going on. And I think very little time is spent and was spent when I was going through it. None was spent talking about you're going to go out and run a practice, which is actually a business. You think you're just going out and treating people, you know, and you get paid, and that's not the way it works. You have staff, you have a facility, you have supplies, you have all kinds of things. Unfortunately, in the United States, you have this absolutely crazy billing system with multiple payers and all their rules and regulations. It's really a very complex business. In Canada, it was a lot easier, one payer. And actually, you know, that was pretty simple. But even then, it was a business. And so when I kind of started out, I didn't have much business experience. Fortunately, I didn't have to. I went to Africa. And I was working for the Canadian government as a public health officer, running a very large operation, which I had no experience in, and had to learn on my feet. And basically, after the person I was replacing left with giving me a little hands-on experience, there were a lot of stuff to learn. And what I found was, which was just something that I found out, that I was kind of an adaptive entrepreneur. I kind of started figuring out and seeing things that weren't working well in the business we were in, which was providing public health to a million people with a budget of $1 per person per year. And you have to figure out how to use that, which is business, and how to judiciously place those resources into the appropriate, you know, operational mode so that you got the best bang for your buck, which is business in a sense. One of the most interesting things was that I was the chief of service for one of the provinces of Cameroon, the Northwest Province, and I would go to these meetings and listen to the other chiefs of service talking about how they weren't getting anything done because their vehicles were always broken down. And it's very interesting because we had a hodgepodge of vehicles, some gifts from the Canadian government, some from UNICEF. They're all different, three Land Rovers, two Volkswagen buses, Renault Jeep, you know, whatever. And I immediately realized our lifeblood was these vehicles because we had a huge territory and a lot of our work was going out on dirt roads, 45 clicks or 45 kilometers, you know, to a health center for our staff to run an immunization clinic, whatever it was. And I realized listening to these stories, knowing what kind of brutal conditions there were for the roads and on these vehicles, that we had to do something different. And we had two drivers who were mechanics. And I thought, gee, you know, we got two mechanics. Why don't we just dig a hole? And rather than we had no lift, so we dug a pit and rolled the vehicle, you know, got a little, built a little kind of affair that protected the, you know, just a tin roof, and I drive in over the pit, and we changed our oil, rotated our tires. Never we lost 15 minutes of we had 15 minutes of downtime in 3 years on our vehicles because vehicle maintenance. I hadn't owned a vehicle to that point, but I realized that because I lived in Montreal, walked to work, I didn't need a vehicle, but I realized that that was our lifeblood. And if we didn't have that, we would be like the other characters I was dealing with at those meetings who would sit and complain about the fact that they didn't have anything anyway. And then, you start to look, and then we were running, my predecessor had started small dispensaries in our health centers because people couldn't afford medication. And the local pharmacies, it was impossible. No one could afford it. So I looked at it, I said, but we've got 27 of these maternities and delivering babies and seeing kids. And we have two dispensaries. Why don't we open our own pharmacy, so to speak, and have them in every one? So we, over 2 years, did that. And we did it on a cost plus basis so that we just earned enough per malaria medication or whatever it was to pay for us getting more. We weren't trying to run a profit. We were just trying to cover our transportation costs. So the price was like very affordable for people. And we were, and it was so affordable that actually I had one of the missionary doctors at a local hospital who used to make their money on selling them tell me that I was ruining his business, because we were doing this and we were getting what we needed to our residents out there at a very, very low cost. And it was a very complex business because we were supplying pharmaceuticals. Now, my dad was a pharmacist, but it didn't help me at all. I mean, this was a totally different operation. Made some mistakes, had a guy stealing, you have all kinds of things going on there. But in general, when I left, the World Health Organization copied that for a province in Nigeria. And one of the guys who had been working with me was involved with them. Yeah, it was a novel idea of just low cost, low profit margin, just, again, just figuring it out, how to do it. This, so when I came.
Well, this adaptive entrepreneurship, right? So you're in this place, you're 23?
No, I was like 25, 26, 27, maybe.
Okay, 26, 27 years old, having learned.
Never run a business in my life, never. I worked summers, teaching swimming at a summer camp or, whatever. I never.
Right. But you also deal with what a lot of us deal with in sales, which product aside, right, whatever the Canadian government's intentions were, you run up against the buyer, we'll say, the individuals with mm-hmm. who live there, right? The people right. of Cameroon, who this is how they've done yeah. it for however long. They've got the goiters and all of the worms in their eyes, all of these issues. Mm-hmm. Why make a change? So talk to us about, because there's this whole like change management process or change influence. Oh. How were you able to come in and say, we want to partner with you and make all these changes because of XYZ?
Oh, well, I had the good fortune of having a very large staff of local folks who knew the local arrangement. And we weren't doing brain surgery. We were just making sure that babies got delivered safely in our, we had maternities in 27 little communities, and we wanted to make sure babies got, and women want to have a safe delivery. That wasn't a big sell, okay?
Well, I'm assuming, was there a high infant mortality rate?
Infant mortality rate, of course. Those countries have very high infant mortality rates because of death in the first year of life, which is a whole other story, which we'll get to. But basically, there was another issue. You, when you had your little girl, went into labor and drove to the hospital and, had a baby, after a little while. Well, a lot of these women are walking 15 or 20 miles from outlying communities, which this health center that we had served. The midwives were excellent. They were all trained and could deliver. They delivered a lot of babies, but you're having women. So we decided, this is not a great idea. Why don't we build some rudimentary structures near the health center where the women could come maybe a couple of days before they think they're due, and they would be very close to what they lived in, in their villages. And we wouldn't have babies being born on the way in, and we wouldn't have babies being born in. And so all of our health centers built the, we had health committees who built these, you know, very rudimentary structures where women could come early and have a bed and also cook and then wait and then go into the maternity, have a safe delivery, and then go home. And again, just figuring out what, you know, the simple things you need to do to get a better outcome in a situation where for years, it was, you know, it was what it was. We had the maternity there. They were all clean. They were all, you could smell the disinfectant. I mean, it was, we made sure, and those, you know, it was amazing how very, very proper those places were, much different than what these women delivered in their villages. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was they had to get there. And so we figured, and there was no transportation. They're walking on paths, you know, through high grassland, because we lived in the high grassland area, savanna. But still, they're walking, you know, who knows how far. And so that was another issue. Then, of course, there's the issue of their kids. No one wants their kids to die. Convincing them to get an immunization was not difficult. Getting them to have an immunization, you know, so we had to figure out ways to get the immunizations out to them. And it was all just, you know, you're talking about what I do now and what was done there and the sell. I'm telling you, selling someone now to get a COVID vaccine is a lot more difficult than talking to one of those folks in Cameroon to get their kids vaccinated so they don't die of measles or whooping cough or polio or whatever else they were dying of, tetanus, whatever else. And I've seen it all, you know, rabies, all these things.
But in Cameroon, you probably had, so as sellers, and you have this yourself, we've talked about it, right? On your buying committee, it's yourself, the, you know, the owner, the partners, sometimes the practice manager, right? Like decisions are no longer made by one. It's usually a committee, committee decision. Whereas in Cameroon, probably the influence of, I'm assuming, those vaccinations and changing that outcome is getting an evangelist, right? Someone who truly understands, also speaks the language, knows the culture, who's then infiltrating these small pockets to really become this evangelist of, hey, everybody, let's get on board to do this. And then you get another evangelist and another and another and another.
Well, we got around that by creating health committees in each, you know, finding some locals in each community village who were interested in, you know, improving things, and which meant water supplies, meant latrines, meant, you know, all kinds of things. And they were instrumental in putting the message out. But it was my job as the, you know, the big kahuna, so to speak, to go, you know, walk, come in there. And I walked into some of those places a couple of times a year, you know, and I would visit all my health centers on a monthly basis just to meet with the health committees to try and give them very rudimentary understanding of why these things were being done. Why, you know, you know, there is a very interesting expression in English, which I won't get to, but you don't crap where you eat, you know. Well, there it was, you've got to deal with human waste because it contaminates the water, which creates the diarrheal disease, which kills your kid before they're 1 year old. And so we had a huge process of these committees digging community latrines, you know, incredible, you know, 20 feet deep, 3 feet wide, 6 feet long, covered over, you know, the whole, I mean, little, you know, these were very simple.
We talk about it a lot in this sense of, right, there's a business problem. So in this sense, off the top of my head, it's like health and safety. It's like you can't fix it immediately, right? It's a epidemic. It is the health and safety of a community. And then you have the impacts, right? The death, you have the numbers, right? The impacts to the family, what's happening. But then you also have this root cause, which is what your team was working in all of these three buckets, right? But as salespeople, we are always like, well, if we can just come in and fix this one thing, it's going to fix everything else. Well, yes, fixing the water supply, but also then you've got, you know, the immunizations and all that, like all comes together in order to fix this big problem.
Of course, but, you know, I see in my work now, I see a lot of physicians who travel overseas to those places and work for 3 weeks in some hospital fixing hernias or doing this or doing that. The reality is they feel good when they come home, okay? And they've helped 20 people, you know? When you look at the problem, when I was there, and we'll get away from this because I'm just using it as an example of how I approach things. You're looking at massive problems that have very simple solutions that require understanding the root problem and getting at it. Sure, fixing someone's goiter, it's marvelous, you know, for that one person. Fixing the water supply for a village or a community is incredibly impactful. And I can tell you that our little hospital was empty when I left of cases of whooping cough and measles and polio and everything, because we had a very simple solution. Get to the people who needed what they needed and get what we, and it was, but again, it was a business solution at looking at what we needed to do to get to the root cause of what was going on and what was the real problem. The most obvious problems you could fix, but you would fix them one at a time. The root problems, you could make a huge difference in the life of that community or from a business sense in how the outcomes looked. Yeah. And so that was a tremendous lesson for me, because when I came back to the United States, I went to, you know, the School of Public Health for a year, but then I went into private practice, which is business. And my partner and I had to run a business. We had to buy a facility. We bought two, actually, and ran two practices, had to employ staff. And oh, there's a learning process there, and the mistakes you make and the things you learn, and fascinating.
So yeah. You went, quick story, you were living in Canada, 80-acre farm, doctor by day, farmer by night and weekends, started your family, moved to the States.
Yeah.
40
years ago, Quebec was trying to separate, and my partner left and left me with the whole practice and two offices and whatever else. It wasn't going to happen. And so we basically, at the time, if you were selling into a buyer's market, not a seller's market. And we left with almost nothing. You know, three kids, one six week old, you and your sister, who were five, four and five or something like that.
I was two.
82, you were born in 79, you were three.
Three.
Almost three. Okay, it didn't matter. You were two going on 15 anyway at the time, if I remember correctly. But I came here and I had a job. I was to be the health commissioner for the county. So I had a salary, but I wanted to open a private practice. But again, had to start all over again with, you know, no, we had not much money coming here because we had given everything away just for to cover the costs of, or the mortgage or what was left. And it came with, yeah, $10,000 or something like that. Anyway, but we didn't know anything and it just started up. But it was 5 years working all by myself, delivering 100 babies a year, working, you know, 7 days a week. Now, it wasn't all 7 days a week. I still got out and ran, and I still had all my kids and went to their games and did everything. But still, I was busy, but I built a small business, took on a partner for another 5 years or 10 years, I forget. And then he left, took on another partner. Then we were in business. Then we decided we were going to expand because...
So hold on one second, because I always ask the guests and... we haven't gotten into that yet. This is a little bit of a different episode. It's not a short. This is going to be a two-parter. So I want to talk about the first question in this, because I think it goes into what you just said. So those first 5 years, and something I've always admired about you, and you and I talk about it definitely a couple times a week, is this concept of your mindset and where to focus and like how to stay in your swim lane. So talk to me about where you learned this practice of betting on yourself, but also this like edge, your sales edge of like having this mindset that is, for the most part, like unshakable. I mean, here and there, right around Iron Man time, it gets a little dicey, but.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there are a couple of things. One is I was very fortunate in one sense. I started practicing medicine in Canada. And that was very a fortunate experience because I can remember, and this is one of those seminal memories I remember. I walked out in my waiting room in this office in Olton, Quebec, and sitting in the waiting room were two women side by side chatting. You know, one worked at the local Clairol plant earning $7.50 an hour. And one was the wife of the CEO of Bombardier, you know, Ski-Doo, snowmobile. They make airplanes. They make subway cars. They make things that make them very wealthy. And they owned a very, 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 very nice place just outside of town. But they both had a little blue card in their hand, which was their ticket to get in to see me. And that was it. I had no need to discriminate as to who was paying me, whatever else. There was a single payer source. So when I moved here, I had no concept of that. And so when I started, I would see everybody. And a lot of the docs wouldn't see the Medicaid, you know, the ones that, and I remember I delivered, I don't know how many babies where we were getting paid, you know, very little for the delivery. No one would touch them. But from my background was you just, that's not what you do with people. Well, the world has a funny way of coming back to look after you, because at a certain point, suddenly the reimbursement per delivery went from $250 to $1,600 a delivery. It was nothing that I had banked on or thought about. I was just doing what I was doing. And suddenly those people who I had given service to, who knew that they were being told that they, you know, they weren't good enough to go somewhere else or whatever else, were my patients. And I had built a very large, you know, practice. You know, fine. I mean, I don't remember what I was earning. It didn't matter. You never missed a meal. You never went for, you know, missing for anything. And maybe our vacations were a little shorter and we didn't go, you know, anyway.
No, I mean, you lived modestly.
Yes, but that's the way it was. But basically, I had built this rather large practice. And I think the reputation also was we saw everybody and looked after everybody. And the moral compass, you know, drove the whole thing. And the hard work, you know, I get called at 2 a.m. to go deliver a baby and I was going to get paid peanuts for it. Didn't matter. That was my job and that's what I did. And the patients really appreciated it. And that was the service I was offering. And I did it with a smile. And it was, you know, it was just one of those things. And they're still my patients now, many years later, and their kids are my patients.
But you have this lesson of this, like, mindset of even when it's tough, right? Not missing workouts. Even still, 50 years later, where does that stem from? Of not letting the outside forces infiltrate here?
I don't know. It just... There were a couple of things that drove part of it. And I've always liked exercise. You know, I was a college athlete and afterwards I ran and, you know, I ran 5 marathons. I skied, you know, ski marathon. I mean, I wasn't fast. I wasn't winning in my age group. I just was out there doing it because it was healthy. And the other thing was I knew that if I walked into the office weighing 300 pounds, smelling a cigarette smoke and tried to talk to someone about not smoking and, you know, staying healthy, it doesn't work. And so I always knew you had to live, you know, the story if you were going to do it and going to teach it. And not for any other reason, but that's the example you have to set when you're in this business. That was just my mindset. Now, am I a little bit nutso about exercise? I don't think so. I just like how I feel when I exercise every day. First of all, it's fairly stressful listening to 20 or 30 people in a day unload on you, you know, about, you know, whatever they've got. Some of them just for coming in for a physical, but some with some significant issues, including having to tell them they've got a serious illness or that they need some interventions or they need to change their lifestyle. And I've always found that having a bit of exercise, usually early in the day, if you can remember me at making the peanut butter sandwiches when you guys woke up and I had already run 6 miles, it was because A, that was the only time of day when I knew I had some time, and B, it set me up for the rest of the day to be, it took a little edge off, I had a little endorphin buzz, I felt a little more relaxed, I didn't get as irritable as you can get when you're tired, and sometimes I'd come home after delivering a baby at 3 a.m. and know that I was going to be up in an hour and a half or 2 hours, so I'd go for a run. And by 6 or 7 at night, it was a long day, but still, I sometimes had to get up that night and do it again. But there's a certain discipline in my life, which is getting some exercise every day. I swam today, by the way, my group, I'm just saying, it's like,
it's just 78 years old, we're still exercising on the daily, although you're coming down from your latest Ironman.
Ironman, and then COVID about a month later. Yeah, that was tough. Yeah. Anyway,
so you see problems every day in the sales world. Many people talk about their product, right? So back in the heyday of drug reps coming in, pharmaceutical reps coming in, talking all about their product, whatnot. I mean, you've seen it, all of the product pitching. And there's a slew of sales advice out there, and we can get to all the advice because you see it as well. But I think there's a lot of parallels here. You know, there's sales advice out there that people are still practicing pitching their product and putting their agenda on you. And then there's those of us that are seeking problems. Are there problems that I can solve here? And I'd love to know, as a practitioner, every day you hear so many problems, how are you weeding through to figure out, A, what's most important? Is this person full of BS? And also, how are you going to influence or help them see that they have to change before bad stuff happens?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the drug reps for a minute, because they come in, and pitch their stuff. And some of them are pitching at you a Me Too that's already 3 or 4 iterations that we've heard from other companies. And I feel bad for them because it's a tough job. But we've gotten to the point now, they come in and they just bring us lunch and we chat about their kids and everything else, because they know they don't have to, and they leave us some samples then go away, because it's almost irksome when they come in and start pitching at you. Hey, I just want one prescription out of you. Can you just try it? Well, give me a break. It's the old hard sell kind of stuff.
Watch Painkillers for anybody out there. You'll see exactly.
Yeah. It makes sense. Yeah, I know. It's just, but anyway, talking about what I have to deal with is where you're going, where I get a patient coming in, and there's a couple of, one is sometimes they need a lifestyle change. Those are the hardest, because you're looking at ingrained issues that have not gone on just for a day or two. Smoking, they've been smoking for 30 years, or they're looking at a history of, if they keep smoking, it's going to be 30 or 40 years before they give it up, at which point they're going to have some significant problems, none of which they have now. And so they can't understand why you're chatting about it, except you have a data set that's like from 1960 on of why they should stop. Then you have the other stuff, which is a little bit more difficult. And that is the preventive care that you have to encourage people to get. Women, mammograms, pap smears. And then you start talking about colonoscopies, and to try and convince people to do those. And then, of course, now with our dear friend COVID around, immunizations and the newer iterations of flu vaccine and RSV vaccine and all this stuff. And they're onto the internet and Facebook and all the craziness out there. And you're having to spend a lot of time trying to undo really bad information that people are getting to get them to understand why it's important for them. That's very difficult. And there are strategies that you have to use, some of which are easy. If you've got a patient who trusts you, it's very easy. They just come in and say, hey, I've heard about this new vaccine. Do you think I should do it? And you talk with them about it, and they're fine. you know, because it's a long-standing relationship. But then you got people who come in and they are not going to, they don't want any part of this. And they're the toughest because you spend a lot of time with them and a lot of them, you don't get to go with them. And the strategies vary from just saying, hey, you know, go ahead, do what you want to do. I'm telling you, a million people died of COVID over the last year and a half in the United States. You've got some risk factors. I think you're making a big mistake, but you can't do anything about it because they saw on the internet and you know, and it's impossible. And then you have the other people who you can convince with some strategies. I have one which I love to use, and I'll explain this to you. You know, we have now four possible issues with colonoscopy. First of all, colonoscopy is life-saving. It's life-saving if you know, used appropriately.
A little PSA, the age was moved up from 50 to 45.
That's right, because we're seeing younger and younger people with colon cancer.
So I'm really excited because my husband turns 45 before I do, and I can't wait for him to go through that before me this coming year.
Yes, but you know what? It's life-saving, and it's the only test we can do that gives you 7 years. It tells you, you don't have to worry for 7 years. You know, we were doing pap smears on women every year, which is a waste of time. But anyway, now it's every 3 years or 5 years, depending on your HPV positive or not. But we didn't know, but this is 7 years. And then we have Cologuard. You can get it in a box in the mail. You poop in it, and it's good for 3 years. Or we can give you a fit kit and you wipe a little poop on it. It's good for a year. People won't do it.
Yeah.
They just don't want to do it because it's poop, you know. And so no matter what you do, you can't convince them to do it. So I figured out a strategy. I bring a little sandwich baggie in and I say, you want to wear one of these on your side, you know, for the rest of your life? That's what happens if you have a colonoscopy. You have this sandwich baggie on you. Oh, boy, I have convinced a whole bunch of people. But again, you have to figure out ways to get people to go because you're trying to get people to do things that they really don't want to do, even though it's in their best interest. And that's a very hard sell. Now, in a business sense, it's important for us to do that, by the way. That's the other side of this, which people don't realize. Most doctors are involved in risk-sharing arrangements when, if you have a pool of people, let's say men and women over 50, should have colonoscopies. Well, if you attain a certain percentage, the insurers have a kicker for you. I'm talking serious kicker, you know, like real money. And the same thing with diabetics. If they get their you can enhance your revenues, which are important because they pay the staff, they pay your salary, whatever else, by about 15 to 20%. So it's really important to get that message across. From a business point of view, it's important, but also deep down, these measures are
right.
They're the standard United States Public Health Service and national guidelines, which are important for people to do. It's not, they're so important that they're incentivizing us to incentivize our patients. Yeah. It is so lucrative for doctors to do this that we were actually giving patients
gift cards, right?
Gift cards to go and have this done. Yeah, why not?
Right.
I mean, it's really, you're incentivizing them to do it, which for you, there's an incentive, but also it's in their best interest.
But right. There's no negative. If you save a life from early detection from a colonoscopy, you can look at yourself in the mirror that night versus selling someone a vehicle they don't need just to line your own pockets. Like there's a...
Of course. But I don't know how many, I mean, a lot of the insurers have gift cards as well. Even with those, it's hard to get people to go, you know,
the same thing in business. You're trying to change. I mean, for you, it's individuals, but you also have a team. It's trying to change a culture often that a product is going to change. You're trying to change behavior. We've always, I mean, how many times did I tell you in my former career, like we've always done it this way. And I'm like, yeah. There's so much revenue opportunity or whatnot. It's just like, because change is hard as humans. And now you add in that personal factor and it becomes like, oh, that doesn't apply to me. I don't want to do it. It's too hard.
Well, on another basis, in 1999, I had some cowboy come to me and say, you know, we've got this computer program you could use in your office, you know. And I looked at it, and it was really not very good. And I saw that there was a conference in New York City on computers and medicine. And I knew that this was, you know, coming, but because it was all paper, and we had gone from paper to, we were dictating our notes, and someone was speaking of business. We went from handwriting our notes, which was just brain dead.
Because nobody can read your notes, yes.
That's right. To dictating our notes, having someone type them, send them back on sticky sheets. We would stick them in the chart. It was costing us $40,000 a year. But it was time for us, you know. I went to this.
Well, hold on. I think this is a good seed for episode number two. Let's talk about the transition of technology in medicine and someone trying to sell you a tech solution. Right. And what happened, because I feel like I was part of this journey as well, where I busted my face open and had to get stitches at your office during all this. So stay tuned if you're listening. Join us for part two, Lessons in Life, Sales, and Medicine with Dr. Robert Burke.